Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is David Dufty, who's a Senior Research Officer at the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Apart from that, he's written a book called How to Build an Android, published by Holt, a fascinating book. David has previously worked as a market researcher and as an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Memphis in Tennessee. He grew up in regional outback towns in New South Wales, Australia, and studied science at the University of Newcastle in New South Wales, majoring in psychology. He obtained a PhD from Macquarie University in Sydney before moving to Memphis. David Dufty, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Hi, Helen. It's great to talk to you and be on your show.
Good. Well, I just finished your book last night as I was flying back from Coffs Harbour, where I was staying with my son, How to Build an Android. And I must say, I was absolutely fascinated by it.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, good.
And I just will tell the audience that we'll get into the subject now, but the essence of the story is that they built this head, which was a replica of Philip K. Dick, who I didn't even know who Dick was. But he's a very famous science fiction writer, and the man who built him was taking him in a sort of duffel bag, a sports bag, to a conference at Google in, I think, San Diego.
San Francisco.
San Francisco, yes. And he was tired and he'd had to get up early and the plane changed somewhere, I can't remember, Las Vegas or something, and he left the head on the plane in the overhead locker and the head got lost. So it's a fascinating story of how the head came about, and it was very funny because they thought they would name the head Dickhead and they realised that wasn't quite right. So let's start.
Wasn't really appropriate.
Not appropriate. Let's start at the beginning, David Dufty, because it's your book, your story. Who was Philip K. Dick? Tell the audience.
All right. Philip K. Dick was a cult science fiction writer who lived in California and who died in 1982. And he was most, I guess, at the peak of his productivity and fame for, actually not the peak of his fame, but peak of his sort of fan base and productivity and sales in the 60s and 70s. He actually grew up on Berkeley campus. His mother worked on Berkeley campus, and he was very much a part of the, you know, grew up in the sort of the core of the countercultural movement in the 60s. He never really, I guess he's one of these artists that never really achieved fame during his lifetime. He wrote furiously all these sort of almost potboiler, I suppose, but certainly, I hate to use that word because some of them are now considered to be actually great literature, but furious paperbacks in science fiction and short stories just to pay the bills, and he used amphetamines to get him through. And then just towards the end of his life, Hollywood started taking an interest in his work, and so they made Blade Runner out of one of his books. It was out of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? He never actually got to see... he got to see a preview of it, but he died before it was actually released. So Philip K. Dick is known in his science fiction for reality-bending science fiction, quite paranoid scenarios, lots of robots, of course, lots of alternate realities, and who am I really a robot, or is my wife an alien, is my husband an alien? That's literally a plot in one of his short stories. There's a... Uh, and So he kind of has his own sort of unique, he almost has his own unique niche, almost a genre of his own in science fiction. And so, but the thing that that really got us, or not me, but got the people who were involved in the project interested, and I guess got me interested as well, even though I was sort of an observer, was the fact that in so many of his stories, it's hard to know whether or not an android is really an android. So if you've ever seen Blade Runner, I'm not sure if you have. But,
I haven't.
Okay, well, there's a character in... well, you know, it is actually routinely rated as the greatest science fiction movie of all time.
Oh, really?
Yes, yes. But anyway, so there's a character in it called Rachel Rosen. So what Harrison Ford's job is to do, and this is all based on the novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, his job is to find these renegade androids and kill them. And they're so perfect. They look so much, they're so similar to humans that that he's got to have this special test to try and find out if they're human or androids. And the Rachel Rosen, who thinks she's a human, she actually works for the company that made them, sits the test, and Harrison Ford discovers that she's actually an android.
Well, what's the definition of an android?
Well, an android is a robot that looks like a human. So it's basically a humanoid robot. So there's sort of different terms, I suppose. A robot is basically any kind of intelligent machine, really.
Yeah, yeah.
An android is an intelligent machine that looks like a human.
Uh-huh.
And the other term that you might hear is sort of being thrown around that people sometimes get confused with those as cyborg, which is a combination of human and machine. And we're actually in that kind of world now. I mean, even with things like artificial ears and artificial everything, really, you basically, once you start becoming a blend of a human and a machine, you're a cyborg. It doesn't sound like a very nice thing, but I actually think that's a positive development for people. But so that's who Philip K. Dick was. And the idea of the robot was to, because this happens more than once in his stories, is there are people who think they're androids. Oh, no, sorry, androids who think they're people. And one of the twists is they discover that they're actually a robot. It happens also in a book called We Can Build You. So they thought it'd be really fun to actually kind of make this concept come to life, is to build an android that claimed to be a human called Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, that's funny.
So that was it was a sort of a geek in joke in a way, quite a clever one really, and also not just an in joke. It was also a really nice comment on the differences between humans and machines. Because as we develop more and more complex machines, they become more like people, and in some cases, as I was just saying, they become part of us. So it was actually intentionally a work of art. I'm not just imposing this after the fact. It really was a work of art as well as a work of science.
Yes, to go back to Philip K. Dick, I found him to be absolutely fascinating. He was clearly eccentric.
Yes.
He was, I wouldn't say mentally unstable, but fascinating. I mean, not the normal sort of psychology you would find in quotes a normal human being, because he was somewhat paranoid, and he did take amphetamines, which he knew aggravated his paranoia, yet gave him insights into certain ways of being, which allowed him to write his books. And he lived a sort of eccentric life, and his house was full of, at one stage, dropouts and young people who couldn't fit into society and the like, which kind of amused me too, because I think the spice of life actually comes from these eccentric sort of people, and often the geniuses of our world are usually pretty eccentric, don't you think, David Dufty?
Yes, I do, because if you want to, because it requires a certain kind of thinking about things not quite the same way as everyone else.
Yeah.
if you're going to come up with interesting insights. And so actually, speaking of that, in terms of Philip K. Dick, he's reputed to have, I can't remember where I read this, but apparently when the whole Watergate thing blew open with Nixon, he thought this was hilarious and laughed. And the reason he laughed was because it completely confirmed his worldview.
Well,
he said, I've been believing this stuff for years, and everyone thought I was, you know, nuts. And look at the TV, it's all true. So
often people who have vision are seen as nuts until what their vision has been comes to fruition.
Yes.
And that was him. Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, I've never liked science fiction because I like science. You know, I like real science. But I must say, when I read your book, David, How to Build an Android, and about Philip K. Dick per se, I thought maybe I better read his books. What is it? The Electric Sheep. What's the name of that book?
Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Dream of Electric Sheep.
Yes.
So and is that one of his classics?
It is considered a classic. So the movie and also the book are sort of structured in a sort of a almost it's sort of a detective novel in a way. He's got to track down, in the style of Dashiell Hammett almost, he's got to track down these terrible androids that are on the loose who should be under control of humans. And so that's basically the plot. Some other classics of his. Well, the one that most had the two that had the most powerful effect on me, I suppose personally, were The Man in the High Castle, for which he won an award, and A Scanner Darkly, which got turned into a movie that didn't do very well.
A Scanner Darkly,
but it was a very interesting movie, and it's a very interesting plot.
Well, now you're a psychologist. What is it about Philip K. Dick that fascinated you from a psychological perspective, David Dufty?
Oh, I don't think. See, I guess the fascination for me is that, I suppose, because I've been reading Philip K. Dick for many, many years. I don't want to say how many, but certainly since I was. I think I started reading him as a graduate student, as an undergraduate student. And it was, I guess the thing that hooked me in was his sort of unique brand of stories of science fiction that was very much dystopian and reality warping, and seemed to me to be very much, it was almost a full frontal attack on your sort of normal worldview and the way things should be. You know, he'd attack it from any direction he could. Mm. You know, as in one story, instead of you, everything's in. You see, things are inverted. In one story, instead of you watching the TV watches you. You know, because the government controls the TV and they have these little hidden cameras.
Which
in
is not so out to lunch these days.
No,
because we're being spied on electronically.
Well,
in many areas of our lives.
Well, this is the other thing about his work, is that supposedly all this unhinged fantasy about police states gone mad that he had, like in A Scanner Darkly, for instance. I'll finish my sentence. All these supposedly unhinged fantasies seem to have kind of come to fruition. In A Scanner Darkly, like he's an undercover cop and he's set up all these invisible cameras to spy on his flatmates. It's heavily inspired by the house he lived in. To my money, it's the best Philip K. Dick book, to be honest. Very depressing, but really, really quite hard hitting. But so when he wrote that, there weren't really invisible. You couldn't set up invisible cameras in people's houses and watch them from a nearby location. And in another book, Flow My Tears, the policeman said, all the data about everybody in society is contained on a huge police database, and you know you have to check in cards and everything, and they know exactly where you are and who you are and what you're doing, and so a lot of this surveillance stuff that he imagined that
is happening.
Yeah, it was science fiction when he wrote it, but it's not anymore.
Well, you know, the CIA has a huge listening base inside Australia, biggest CIA base in the world called Pine Gap, and they spy on all our domestic communications and international communications, and they've been doing that for many years. So this is not out of the realm of reality. So let's get on to why did they build the android of Philip K. Dick? Were these people fascinated by Philip K. Dick's work and they wanted to make a kind of android who could think and talk and the like? Is that what happened?
Well, yeah, there were two things. Okay, the first thing was they wanted to make an android, and this was because a team got together. Basically, some people from different universities met from the University of Memphis, who did mostly AI stuff and software.
Well,
and
AI is artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's right. It's artificial intelligence. So they had all, they ran all the computer programs and could make programs that could interact and converse and talk to you, but not so much the robotics, the actual machinery. They could do it all on computers, but there was no machines to put it in. You just do it on a desktop, really. When they teamed up with David Hansen, who's this amazing roboticist from Texas, and so the concept was, he came to Memphis a couple of times and had talks with them, and the concept was, hey, you know, the guys from Memphis said, hey, look, we're doing great AI. You're building the most advanced robot heads in the world. Let's put the two together. You know, let's put these, let's marry these and see what we can do.
Yeah.
And David Hansen said, that's a great idea, and I've got the perfect idea for it. And that is, let's make it a head of Philip K. Dick.
And David Hansen was a sculptor, so he was able, through photographs, to recreate the actual head that looked very, very like Philip K. Dick.
Yes, it did. And because he was an artist, he came up with, that was really a profoundly artistic insight, whereas I think the Memphis guys were thinking about it more from just a technical point of view, let's just do something sort of technical and clever, and he added that extra thing to it, which was really a brilliant insight to do that. And then they loved it. I mean, because the core people involved all knew who Philip K. Dick was, and those who didn't soon found out. And so they decided that this would be a great, it would be very sort of ironic, you know, and a recursive, because, you know, he's a robot that thinks it's Philip K. Dick, who wrote stories about robots who think they're humans.
So
it was his idea to do it, and it was really, and I think that was one of the attention grabbing thing about it. So when I went to NextFest, for instance, in Chicago, which was where it first appeared before the public, it got a lot of attention. It was extremely popular.
Well, fascinated me was Hansen made the head, and he had this material called frubber.
Yes, he invented
which was a sort of rubbery compound but felt like skin. And so they put underneath the skin of the face all these little connections which worked with little motors so that they could emulate or simulate the facial expressions of a normal person as they talk. And it so effective that when they took the head to the first festival that you just referred to, people were absolutely fascinated because they could ask this robot questions. The robot would look at them, listen, and then give them answers. And what they did was computerized, because it had been interviewed hundreds of times and all the interviews had been recorded. So what they did was put all the recordings of his interviews into a computer, and then the computer worked out which words were in which conversations and the like. So when people asked him a question, the computer would go and work out what the relevant answer would be. I found that fascinating, David Dufty.
Yes, and so imagine if everything in your life was recorded, everything you said was recorded,
yeah,
and voluntarily. So you decided to do it
Yeah.
Let's not get into the surveillance stuff that we were just talking about. It could actually happen, I suppose, anyway. And everything that you write online is possibly recorded for posterity. But let's just say that you choose that all the conversations you have with people are recorded. And then somebody over a period of many, many, many years, then what somebody could do is then simulate you because they have a large enough database, so they have millions and millions of things that you've said, then if with a good enough search algorithm, if anybody asks an Android version of you a question, the Android can find an answer. And if it can't find an answer, it can find a similar answer by finding two things that are kind of okay, chopping them in half and splicing them together.
And we often talk like that anyway. We lose our train of thought or we get mixed up. And so when the Android did that, when people were talking to it, people were amused and they laughed because that was a sort of a human fallibility that they all had experienced.
That's right. And so the human... So this is another interesting thing is that... The robot was considered to have, not worked, and sometimes this happens with other artificial intelligence programs. They're considered to have sort of not worked somehow if they say something that doesn't make sense or if they go wrong or they say a non sequitur. But it occurs to me that it's actually too tough a test on robots and artificial intelligence because humans, firstly, humans just make automatic responses all the time.
Yeah.
Hi, how are you? Good, how are you?
Yeah.
You know,
and robotic responses.
Yeah, robotic responses, you might even call them. And then, and there's no sort of great deep consciousness going on there. And the other thing is we make mistakes, we mishear, we say things that are wrong or inconsistent or don't make sense, and not all the time.
I was fascinated when the president of the University of Memphis interviewed the robot of Philip K. Dick, and it was a very interesting conversation. Then he finally said to her, "Have you been exposed to any dangerous practices or something?" Implying that she'd been doing some sexual activities which could have been dangerous.
It was an amazing thing interview to watch. I was there actually.
Oh, you were there! Wow.
Yeah, I was. It was funny, but it was also, I guess,
intrusive.
And also we were concerned. There was some concern about how it was going because this is a very important person.
Yeah.
She hadn't really been involved in the project, and so you don't want to. You don't want to embarrass somebody like that with all these sort of...
Well, she got up and walked away, although her interview... I mean, the interviews were only 2 minutes, weren't they?
Or oh, yeah. I think Andrew Olney decided to just finish it up because the interview had gone okay. It was a little bit, shaky, but it was time to wrap it up because you never knew what the android was going to say.
Was going to say next.
Because it was, like we were saying...
Instead of
it had this vast database of all the things that Philip K. Dick had ever said,
and
those weren't your typical conversation campers.
I like the fact, too, that he was dressed in Philip K. Dick's clothes and he sort of sat back on the couch, and the couch was a simulation of the sort of 1960s ranch house in California. But the front of his head was him and he had his beard and his hair, but the back of his head was just consisted of hundreds of wires all coming out of the back of his head, which is kind of a metaphor for our brain anyway.
It is.
Because the neuronal connections and synapses are kind of like that. I found that fascinating as a physician.
I actually got conflicting versions of how that came about. One version... When I was interviewing people for the book, one version was that it was done on purpose as a sort of a comment.
Yeah.
And then, but the one that I included in the book, which is, I think, what actually happened, was that it just happened that way.
And they didn't have time to finish it and cover it up.
But then they talked about it and realised that, this is actually a nice artistic touch. Well, a sort of a shocking artistic touch. Mm. Because if it didn't have all the exposed wires at the back of the head, you could just be talking to a mannequin.
I think it was real.
And that would be possibly very soothing, but to be talking to someone with their sort of half their skull exposed and there's all these, circuitry underneath, That's a very unnerving experience.
Well, you know, sometimes we operate on people when they're conscious and have part of their brain exposed and stimulate part of the brain with electrodes.
Right.
And get them to respond in a, or the brain to respond in a certain way. So, you know, there is a sort of an analogy of the robot to human beings in that sense. But I'd like to move on to something that, that's interests me, but concerns me, David Dufty.
Yeah.
David, to reintroduce him, is a senior research officer at the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and he is a psychologist, and he wrote this book, How to Build an Android, published by Holt, that you point out in the book that a lot of the things that we interact with now are robots. For instance, and it drives me crazy, I make a telephone call,
yeah,
and they say, do you want personal advice, press 1, do you want this, press 2, do you want this? So you press 1 and then you get onto another set of questions from a robot, and then finally, after about 10 minutes of going stark raving mad, you get onto an actual human being. So you you point out, and then in the FedEx building where this whole situation was created to build the Android head and stuff, there's a desk where you look in the screen and the screen interacts with you to ask you questions, to tell you where to go and stuff. So we're already living partly in a world of robots, if you will. That's a bit freaky.
Yes, it is. Just firstly, to come back to the FedEx interactive sort of what's the word, the person at the desk who greets you, that I mentioned in the book. That was developed, actually, there was two competitions, they had a competition to see which one they would fund, and they actually funded that one over the Android, so the Android people had to just go and find all their own money, and which wasn't very much, and just do it on whatever funding they could scrape together. Mm-hmm. But this intelligent kiosk, that's what it was called.
Intelligent kiosk, yes.
Yes, it was actually quite, it was actually very cutting edge at the time that it was built. But that was only 7 years ago now, and now it's not at all. They're ubiquitous. You go into shopping malls now, and you know they don't do it exactly quite the same way with the same level of sophistication. You don't have a head on the screen talking to you and interacting with you in that way. But the basic concept has really taken off. But at the time, it was still really new. So things move very fast. So, but what was the question was about, yes, where we interact with robots all the time, and it's going to increase. But I think the good news is that they'll probably get better. For instance, I think a lot of the time when technologies first come into the world, they're often not very good. They'll be better than what replace them in some way or other, but they don't work very well, and that can cause a lot of frustration. But then over time, they get improved, and so possibly, I imagine, I could be completely wrong, but I imagine that all the sort of the infuriating and frustrating phone mazes that we go through, I think of them as sort of a labyrinth sometimes, because you've got to press all these numbers to get to the right place. They may disappear, and we may have much more fluid and natural interactions with, well, what are essentially robots on the other end of the line.
Well, I'd like to go back to something. When my mother was alive, she was probably the most intelligent, visionary person I ever knew. And she died many years ago. But when about 40 years ago or 45 years ago, she was saying that computers would put people out of work and out of jobs. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, instead of having a person at the desk, they've got a bloody computer. And it's so in every area, David, you know, they're firing people left, right and centre from banks and from corporations. You look at how cars are built now. They don't use people. They use computers to put cars together. So what's the use? I mean, in the end, people will be useless. It's really serious in terms of societal dynamics. What are people going to do except serve coffee and make cakes? I mean,
you think robots can't serve coffee and make cakes?
Well, there you go. There you go.
No, seriously.
I'm serious too. You're serious.
Yeah, no, I was just
it was a good joke.
Yeah, okay. But okay. I think there's I think that often automation and robotics can actually lead to a net good. So if
like what?
Well, if things are able to be done more efficiently and better and faster,
and put more people out of jobs.
Well, that's the thing I was going to get to. So the problem is, okay, firstly, it does it increases what economists call productivity, and probably increases net wealth and all the rest
for
of it.
For a certain small percentage of the population.
Right, but my point is that it does have a positive. Okay, I was just going to get to the positive before the negative. So it does have a positive, and that in that you can do things better, more efficiently, in new ways, in different ways, and the theory is this is the economic theory, is that frees other people up to do other things, and to do other to
like
play a role in other parts of the economy. But what we've found is this is the flip side. What we have is, in all Western economies now, we have basically an unmovable underclass, all right? And it's not really going away. You have a certain, you have a group of people that are basically unemployed and who have generations of unemployment. And so you have, I think the problem is, what do you do with unskilled people who don't have unskilled jobs? You know, so
making cars,
and not just making cars. I mean, just across the whole,
whole
I mean, call centers. I mean, I know this isn't really to do with robots, but you know, I mean, call centers being moved overseas, that's certainly a problem. In Australia, I'm not. I believe it does happen in America too.
Yes, it does.
But and I guess there's over the past couple of decades, really, there's been massive changes in the employment landscape, and so there have been some positives to that, I think, with society, but also there's been some negatives, and one of the negatives is you get stuck with the society finds itself with, you know, percentage of people who are basically not working.
A large percentage.
Yeah, a large percentage and growing percentage of people who aren't working.
So my mother was right.
Well, I guess so.
We have to be frank. She was right, and it's growing. And I'll tell you what else worries me, David Dufty. I interviewed a man who lives in Palo Alto who's into artificial intelligence, and he predicted that in not very many years, like in a decade or so, computers will be able to virtually do everything that we do and will be able to think like us and behave like us. But I said, well, what about injecting morality into these robots? And that's where the conversation kind of ground to a halt, because you can't do that. Do you want to comment on that?
Oh, yeah, you can, it's a matter of whether, you can in theory, but it's a matter of whether or not it's actually practical to implement that as a sort of a social goal, I suppose.
But what, one person's morality may not be another person's morality.
Well, there's a lot of talk about what to do with robots and the ethics of robots, and actually Peter Singer, the ethicist,
yes,
really wrote a book on it. And so there's all these questions about, and of course the ethics isn't really, there's two sides of it. The one is whether or not robots can make ethical choices, which, you know, you can argue about, but the real, where the rubber really hits the road, is about humans. It's not about the machine.
Mm.
It's about humans making ethical choices to do with robots, to do with how to build them, to how to design them, how to utilize them. So,
all right. Well, let's cut to the chase. The way robots are used in the military.
The way the robots are used in the military, well, since the military is the biggest driver of robotic research.
Of course.
Yes. And in fact, David Hansen.
How to improve their killing.
And in fact, David Hansen said one of his motivations for wanting to build these robots, these beautiful robots that he builds, these robot heads, is that he wants to show that it doesn't have to all be about military funding, and that robots can be a force for good, and can be, you know, can be something that are just just beautiful for people to appreciate and bring an extra something into people's lives.
But as you said, the main drive and the main dynamic and most of the money is in the military, and it's about killing, David. Would you like to expound on what the military is doing with robots?
Well, it is about killing, and then so in fact, like things like, I mean, even you've got these drones.
Drones.
You have
long-distance killing.
Well, and they've got developments like there's even prototypes now. There's a sort of a pack bot, which is basically it's supposed to be on the model of a horse that carries along your luggage, but it looks like a huge Doberman running along. I'd find it really scary, even though it doesn't actually do any damage to anyone. But yes, so they're developing all these. Developing machines that are going to end up making life or death decisions, you know, and so ultimately. So the more autonomy you put into it,
What is a pet bot? I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, that's just a pack bot. That's just, it hasn't actually, I don't think it's actually in production yet, but they've certainly developed some prototypes. It's this huge horse-like thing, and you can, the soldiers can put all their stuff on it, and then it runs along beside them.
What
so if they're
stuff?
Sort of if they're sort of on the march, they've got this thing that can carry all this heavy machinery and guns and weapons and bombs and, you know, as well as food and, you know, all the rest of it.
Instead of them being laden with all the stuff they carry on their backs now.
So that's not actually directly killing people.
No.
But what it is it makes it
easier for the soldiers to kill people.
Yes, exactly. It is making it easier. And so I think there's a real there's no way around it. Developing better systems for killing people is of concern.
It's evil.
Yes.
And then talk about how the military, particularly the Pentagon, uses robotic computers to move troops around the world. I didn't know about this.
Well, I'm not going to profess to be an expert on this, but the basic idea is, so it's not just about artificial intelligence and robotics isn't just playing a role on the front line. It's also playing a role behind the scenes. And so they can they have very clever systems that they use to monitor where resources are needed and predict where to send soldiers and basically deploy their soldiers in the most efficient way possible. So rather than being stuck with, you know, extra soldiers in the Pacific that really need to be in Iraq for whatever reason, they can coordinate and do it all much more efficiently and quickly.
Yes, and I remember when they first developed drones just after one of the Gulf invasions, and the think tanks, people in the think tanks were in Washington were ecstatic because they said, now we can go into battle and kill people without losing our soldiers. And I just nearly vomited. I had never read anything so immoral and so disgusting. And now the drones have become so sophisticated, you know. And then the New York Times had that article about Obama, who's become fascinated by killing certain people in Afghanistan.
He's heavily into the drones. He loves the drones.
And so what they do is they kill certain people that they've targeted who think they might be, quotes, terrorists or whatever, which is a misnomer anyway. And then what they do is they kill people who go to the funeral of that person they've killed because they assume those people too are involved in the terrorism. I mean, this is...
Yeah.
It's beyond evil, David.
This is...
And they kill wedding parties and they kill children and, you know, and, you know, it's like those, what do they call those planes that Hitler sent, all those putt-putt bombs that went over London, and you'd hear them bup, 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 and the sound would stop and down the bomb would come. I can't remember what they were called, and killing people from the sky. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, and so I agree, and the worst thing about these technologies, well, let me first make the most charitable case I can for it, okay? And that is, you can argue, and a lot of people do, and a lot of people honestly believe that, yes, these drones, it's not, and these new methods of killing are not are not good, but at least we're killing people who are sort of, you know, conspirators in acts of, you know, terror and or
how
whatever.
How do we know that's rhubarb?
Well, let's say that they honestly believe it's true, and possibly it is true,
right.
But that's not the point, all right?
Okay.
The point is, let's give the most charitable case possible and say, even in this situation, all right, let's assume they're right, and that these killings are justifiable, mm-hmm. and actually saving a lot more lives, because the option is to sort of do a landing party and go in with guns blazing and kill a lot more people. Okay, fine, whatever. But the problem is that you've now created two things, a technology and a precedent. And so now, mm. for the rest of civilization, from now till eternity, these systems exist for any government, and not any government or any person in power, not even governments really, but mostly governments, to use these technologies to basically kill whoever they want to kill from afar. And not only does the technology exist, the precedent exists for doing it. And because it's been done in a way that's seen by a lot of people to be morally, at least at minimum, equivocal, it's kind of snuck in the door. There's no outrage.
Yeah.
But now, from now till 1,000 years, 2,000 years from now, these things will still be around. Are they still going to be used, you know, in these constrained manners, or will they be? I mean, what's going to happen to these technologies? Because once it's out there, it's out there.
And any country can get them.
Yeah, and even if they can't now,
they will
in the future. I mean, it's only a matter of time. So, yeah, I mean, I'm talking in this sort of the long term. Even if, say, the United States decides to keep all these technologies under lock and key for 100 years, okay, fine. What happens in 101 years?
Yeah, but they'll be selling them abroad to make money, you know. They already are. I mean, Israel's got drones, and other countries have got drones already.
Right.
And they're using.
So this is the problem: is you get these new technologies, and it comes down to the more autonomous they become. You know, you have these bomb-seeking robots and all these scout robots. You have scout all kinds of robots. Basically, have all these machines doing the job of humans, which is a lot safer than humans doing, but ultimately...
Except for the humans getting killed.
Well, ultimately what you're doing is, if they're truly autonomous, you have to give them life, you know, decisions over life or death, and that's a very, very scary thing. And
I don't know where the world's going. Do you know, as we talk, I've got a terrible sinking feeling in my gut. Because with my mother predicting 50 years ago about computers putting people out of work, that is so, so true now, so true.
Yeah.
And America hardly produces anything anymore except weapons. That's the truth. The biggest, you know, production line in America is the military-industrial complex. And, you know, the car industry is on the way out, all the rest. And it's kind of the service industry where the American service... the money that is coming in from their corporations, which have taken either the jobs offshore to countries like China and the like, where labor's very cheap and Americans don't matter, they're just interested in the labor, and or where the corporations are using robots now to produce things that humans once did. You're a psychologist, you've thought about this quite deeply. David, where do you think it's going to end up?
Well, I think in terms of my own personality, I'm fundamentally an optimist, and so I kind of bring that to bear on my outlook for the world.
What, you're a technological optimist?
No,
or
just human
optimist.
I guess I'm an optimist that things will turn out okay in the end for humans. And so, I mean, it's hard to say that when we've just been talking about, you know, new technologies for killing and new technologies for waging war, which basically become more destructive and so forth. But I think I don't believe that the world will go to hell in a handbasket, or at least, let me qualify that, all the world will go to hell in a handbasket. we still will have wars and we'll still have destruction and so forth. But I would like to believe that, you know, society will recover from whatever problems we create for ourselves and go on to better
things. Well, how will people be employed? Doing what? Making baskets?
That's
growing their own food, you know? I can't sort of visualize the future, David, because what really gets me, and I want to talk to you about this as a psychologist, many of the people, and you describe them in your book, How to Build an Android, they're technological whiz kids. I'm sure quite a lot have Asperger's. They've got hypertrophied left brains, really brilliant, not terribly in touch, I think, some of them with their emotions, and some of them do, but you know what I'm talking about,
I do, and I think it's true that that sort of that type of personality, if not sort of Asperger's per se, but that kind of nerdy, quiet, introverted,
geeky,
logical thinking, rational thinker, is more prevalent in sort of technological circles,
particularly males.
Yes,
and this—that's not a sexist comment.
That's just an
observation.
Men and women. Yep.
Yeah. So you've got these people who are not really conscious to the or aware of the larger implications of what they're up to, being funded to a large degree by the Pentagon, because they love this stuff, you know, it makes their mouths water. And then they're moving rapidly into areas which the common person doesn't understand, including myself.
Right.
Which are not being explained to people at all, and into artificial intelligence. I have to tell you, David, it kind of freaks me out, and I got that feeling from looking at the people in your book who were involved in just this very minimal
project. You got a glimpse.
Yes,
I got a glimpse of the sort of people who are working on this stuff.
I did.
Yeah. That's good. I'm glad you got that out of it, actually, even though it did freak you out.
Well, it's important to understand and be freaked out, I think.
Yeah, it is, and it's important to understand. But you're absolutely right. There are certain, I guess, personality traits that go along with that kind of work, engineering and technological work. Those traits are more prevalent in men than women, but not exclusively. I agree. People tend to, a lot of the times people just have a task in front of them, and that's what they work
See,
on.
See, it's
or
really
the problem.
Interesting to bring this back to Philip K. Dick. With feet on the ground, because he's the one with his sort of extracorporeal sort of vision that he could see where this sort of thing was leading, and that's what he wrote about in his book. So isn't it funny that the person that you wrote about in your book had a kind of an innate understanding that no one else had about where this was leading? Isn't that interesting, David?
Yes, it is. And I'll tell you a really scary Philip K. Dick novel that I read. A lot of them are quite scary. In fact, he was a master of scary futures, which is, I think, one thing people find fascinating about him and about his work, is that all these terrible things that could befall humans.
Yeah.
But I remember one short story by him in which it's basically the end of the world. It's all over. And what's happened is, and it's basically the last few soldiers on Earth kind of thing after a war to end all wars. But what's happened is that the military complex kept designing better and better robots that looked more and more like people.
What they're doing, yeah.
Yes. Well, they're not building them more like people yet.
No, they don't
look
like people.
But that will come in the fullness of time. It might not be for a while yet,
right,
though. But it will. But these robots have become fully autonomous in that they can build their own robot factories, and that they can make their own modifications to their own robot factories. And so once they can build their own factories and make themselves and modify themselves, they don't need people anymore. And so you get this evolution of robots and of robot soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the end, the last few soldiers on Earth aren't actually fighting each other. They're trying to they're stuck in a bunker. They know that one of them is a robot soldier that's there to basically that could kill them all at any moment, and they're trying to figure out which one he is.
Oh.
So, yeah, that was a fairly freaky story, and it didn't end well.
Well, you know, when I interviewed this person on artificial intelligence, that's the scenario he created, where robots could create themselves.
Well, there has been some work on that, actually, in terms of robots that build, I mean, only on a simple level, I guess, but
at
robots
the moment,
that build robot factories and then robots that self-replicate, basically, is the idea, just like organic life forms. So, that's...
Well, I think you need to write another book, David.
Oh, really?
Dufty.
What
yes.
about...
Well, on this subject, I think you need to extrapolate from How to Build an Android, which was a simplistic project in light of the discussion we've just had, to move on to extrapolate from a psychological perspective, and you are a psychologist, taking into account what makes a human and what makes us think. I know you've talked about that in your book, how complex the brain is and how a robot can't even sort of cross the road because it can't take in all the problems about crossing a road. Is a car moving too fast? Did I look this way? And the like. But not just that, but what, from a philosophical, I suppose, a Peter Singer point of view, where this will lead. I think we can't have enough books on this subject.
I agree.
And I think that should be your next really big project.
Well, thanks for the suggestion, Helen. That's a really good suggestion.
What would you call it?
How
to survive in a robotic world.
Yeah, one thing I learned is that, you know, titles are hard.
Titles are very hard, yes, that's right. Well, look, you've had some fantastic reviews in the New York Times. And where else? Tell us where else your book has been reviewed.
The best review so far was in The Spectator in the UK. The UK magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the UK, my book's not called How to Build an Android. It was published under a different title, Losing the Head of Philip K. Dick. But that review, I think I was the proudest of. I mean, because the guy, I felt, really got it. He really understood what I was trying to do.
Which was? What in essence, what was it?
Explore the issue of what it means to be human.
Yeah. Well, what does it mean to be human?
Well,
in three sentences.
I don't actually answer the question. I just raise it, I think.
Your next book is about.
Yeah, but the other thing I did, I think, was that I captured, and I think he sensed that as well. The other thing that's really in the book is that it's a book about loss. It really is, and it's about the loss of something beautiful, a great work of art, and I think that was very sad, and so that was the other thing that I think you got out of it, but also just the exploration of how the android was built and all its quirks.
Well, I love the fact that you went to the lost property office in, where was it?
Alabama, Scottsboro, Alabama. Yep.
Yeah, and you went through, you know, warehouses and stuff that people leave on aeroplanes. I mean, most amazing stuff they leave, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually genuinely hopeful of finding the android there, but it just didn't work out.
What do you think happened to it?
Well, it got put on a plane in Orange County, and it never arrived in San Francisco.
But what do you think happened to it?
My fear is that it's actually landfill.
Oh, really?
That's what I think.
I think someone stole it.
It could have been stolen. That's actually... That's a possibility too, but I have no idea who.
They've got it in their sitting room looking at it.
Well, yeah. So if anybody has it, I would be...
Think a cleaner in the plane just ripped it out, didn't even look in the bag and sent it off to the rubbish tip?
Possibly. Either of those possibilities are quite... I think both of those possibilities are live, or that it went to another lost property office and then got picked up by somebody.
It's very sad, isn't it?
It is.
I had that same sense of grief. It's like losing your own head.
Yeah, that's what motivated me to write the book.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been absolutely fascinating, David.
Thanks, Helen.
In more ways than one, I have to say, I would say to everyone, you really must read this book, How to Build an Android, and you must ponder the lessons that David points out in the book and the ramifications of what he was writing about.
Thanks.
And then, David, your next assignment is how to live. What does it really mean to be human in a world of androids? Or
that's a very good question too. What does it mean to be human in a world of robots and androids?
I know, and but extrapolate into the future, like T.K. Dick did, and imagine a world. What, you know, because this is developing so fast. I mean, I had no idea till I interviewed this AI guy how fast artificial intelligence is moving.
Oh, very fast.
And the funding that's going in by Hewlett-Packard and these huge corporations and stuff, where the hell is it going to lead?
Yep.
That's what I'd like to read if you actually wanted to investigate that.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you, David Duffy.
All right.
Very
Thanks,
much.
Helen. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I've really enjoyed it.
Good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
David. Bye-bye. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was David Duffy, who's a psychologist, a senior research officer in the Australian Bureau of Statistics, but more importantly, he's written a book called How to Build an Android, published by Holt, which I strongly advise everyone to read because it leads to a kind of unearthly scenario for the future. Okay, that's enough for today, enough deep thinking. And we'll be back with you next week with another really interesting program. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.